Lucinda Berry's psychological thriller, The Perfect Child, has captivated millions of readers since its publication, becoming an instant bestseller and earning praise from Stephen King, who called it disturbingly brilliant. The novel's unflinching exploration of childhood trauma, adoption challenges, and mental health has resonated deeply with readers and mental health professionals alike. Drawing from her background as a trauma psychologist, Berry crafts a narrative so authentic that many readers report having to remind themselves it's fiction. The book has sparked important conversations about the foster care system and the complexities of parenting traumatized children, with several celebrity book clubs, including Reese Witherspoon's, selecting it for discussion. What makes this story particularly haunting is how it challenges our assumptions about innocence, family bonds, and the limits of love. Hannah and Christopher Bauer's journey begins with the familiar pain of infertility. Hannah, a nurse, struggles with the cruel irony of her situation, caring for children daily while unable to have her own. Her husband, Christopher, a skilled surgeon, supports her through failed treatments and a devastating adoption attempt. Their marriage, though loving, carries the weight of unfulfilled dreams. When Christopher encounters Janie, a severely malnourished and abused toddler brought to his hospital, something shifts within him. This tiny girl with a distended stomach, disproportionately large head, and nearly bald with only tufts of blonde hair immediately captures his heart. Despite her horrific condition, multiple untreated fractures, scars covering her body, and signs of severe neglect, Janie smiles shyly and reaches for Christopher with bent fingers, asking if he'll fix her. The connection between them is instantaneous and profound. Christopher becomes obsessed with Janie's case, spending every spare moment with her during her recovery. He teaches her to play games, brings her markers for her cast, and becomes her primary source of comfort. When Hannah finally meets Janie, she too feels drawn to help this child who has suffered so much. What begins as a desire to give Janie temporary stability while she recovers from surgery evolves into something more permanent. The Bowers apply to become emergency foster parents, driven by Christopher's conviction that they can provide the love and security Janie desperately needs. Their home inspection goes well, and soon they're granted temporary guardianship, a dream come true, especially for Christopher, who believes wholeheartedly that love will heal Janie's wounds. Their journey reflects the universal longing for parenthood and the belief that love can overcome any obstacle. Yet beneath this hopeful beginning lurks the reality that some wounds run deeper than even the most devoted parents can reach. From the moment Janie enters the Bowers' home, signs of her profound trauma begin to surface. What initially appears as typical adjustment difficulties quickly reveals itself as something far more disturbing. During her first home visit, Janie demands food from their locked refrigerator, throwing a tantrum when denied. The next day, she erupts into violent, rageful screams without warning, bites Christopher, spits in Hannah's face, and begins banging her head on the wooden floor with such force that they must physically restrain her. These episodes become a regular occurrence in the Bauer household. Janie's fits can last for hours, filled with uncontrollable rage that requires physical restraint to prevent her from hurting herself. The triggers are often mysterious, though certain things like taking away food or being told no are guaranteed to set her off. She's hyper-aware and easily overstimulated, hiding under the bed on trash day and tearing off her clothes as if they burn her skin. More concerning behaviors emerge. Janie isn't potty trained, despite being 6 years old. She hoards food, and she lacks basic skills like using silverware. She's manipulative, behaving differently with each parent to drive wedges between them, what their therapist, Dr. Chandler, calls triangulation. With Christopher, she's sweet and affectionate. With Hannah, she's defiant and cruel, even refusing to speak to her for weeks. The situation escalates when Hannah becomes pregnant unexpectedly. Janie's jealousy manifests in increasingly disturbing ways, pinching her friend Elodie at school to see what people look like when they cry, pushing the same child off a slide and breaking her arm, and ultimately killing her pet kitten Blue with a safety pin because she wanted to see if she'd bleed. Dr. Chandler diagnoses Janie with reactive attachment disorder, a condition affecting children who couldn't form healthy attachments to caregivers at an early age. The symptoms match Janie perfectly: charm in public settings, manipulation, triangulating relationships, and hurting animals. Though treatment is possible, the road ahead looks increasingly daunting for the Bowers. These behaviors aren't random acts of malice, but manifestations of profound trauma. Janie's early years with her grandmother Sue were marked by neglect and abuse. Sue described her as an unsettling baby who never slept, but never cried either, just stared at the ceiling, emotionless. As Janie grew, Sue claimed she became uncontrollable, and her solution was whooping her good, claiming Janie's eyes would turn black as night. Later, with her mother Becky, Janie experienced further trauma, including being tied up in a closet. The novel forces us to confront uncomfortable questions. How do we help children whose earliest experiences have taught them that the world is unsafe and adults cannot be trusted? Can love alone heal the deepest wounds of trauma? The birth of Cole, Hannah, and Christopher's biological son creates a perfect storm in the already fragile Bauer household. Cole arrives after a difficult labor, and Hannah falls instantly in love with him. However, their bliss is short-lived when Cole begins screaming inconsolably for hours on end, diagnosed with colic that could last for months. Hannah, already exhausted from childbirth, becomes increasingly sleep-deprived and anxious. She experiences terrifying intrusive thoughts, a strange voice urging her to grab scissors, followed by images of stabbing Cole. Other visions plague her: Cole's head hitting door frames, his spine snapping when Christopher holds him. These symptoms of postpartum psychosis go unreported and untreated as Hannah spirals deeper into paranoia. Meanwhile, Janie's behavior worsens dramatically. She regresses, having accidents deliberately and demanding help with everything, especially when Hannah is nursing Cole. She pinches Hannah's breast hard when denied breast milk and kicks Cole's carrier, knocking him onto the floor. The tension in the house becomes unbearable, with Hannah obsessively cleaning, keeping Cole strapped to her constantly, and avoiding Janie, even confining her to her room with a baby gate. The situation reaches its breaking point when Janie kills her pet cat Blue by putting a pillow over its head and sitting on it. Hannah becomes convinced that Janie is evil and might harm Cole or even kill them in their sleep. Christopher, though disturbed, continues to defend Janie, creating a deep rift in their marriage. Hannah's mental state deteriorates rapidly. She begins locking Janie in her room during the day, leaving her naked, surrounded by toys and food, with feces smeared on the walls. When Christopher discovers this, he's horrified and slaps Hannah across the face in a moment of rage, the first act of violence in their marriage. The ultimate tragedy occurs when Hannah, in the grip of psychosis, attempts to drown Janie in the bathtub. During the struggle, baby Cole is accidentally injured, suffering a head injury when his skull cracks against the porcelain tub. All three are found soaking wet: Hannah, catatonic, Janie with a dislocated shoulder, and Cole unresponsive. This harrowing sequence reveals how quickly a family can unravel under the combined pressures of trauma, mental illness, and inadequate support. The Bowers, once so confident in their ability to help Janie, find themselves at the center of a child abuse investigation, with both children removed from their care. The consequences of Hannah's actions ripple outward, destroying lives beyond the immediate family. Cole is hospitalized with a brain hemorrhage, but eventually recovers. Hannah is committed to a psychiatric ward after threatening to jump out a window when authorities try to take Cole. She's diagnosed with a psychotic break from postpartum depression, heavily sedated and barely recognizable to Christopher when he visits. Janie and Cole are placed with Hannah's sister Allison, but the arrangement quickly deteriorates. Janie's behavior becomes increasingly problematic. She bites Allison hard enough to draw blood, smears feces on walls, steals food, and attempts to be sexually inappropriate with Allison's sons. Overwhelmed and frightened, Allison tells Piper she can no longer care for the children. Before alternative arrangements can be made, another tragedy strikes. Janie, overhearing Allison's conversation with Piper about sending her away, confronts her at the top of the stairs. During the altercation, Allison falls to her death. Nanny cam footage later reveals Janie's feet rushing forward before Allison plummets down the stairs, and chillingly, Janie doesn't move from her spot for over 7 minutes after Allison falls. Hannah, upon learning of her sister's death, erupts in rage, screaming, "I should have killed her! She's a monster!" with such violence that orderlies must restrain her. The grief transforms into primal screams as they carry her away. The final devastating revelation comes when investigators discover videos on Becky's recovered phone showing Janie tied up in the closet. But the videos also reveal something shocking: Janie attacking Becky, slashing her neck in a violent assault that resulted in 16 stab wounds. The footage documents Janie's disturbing behaviors and Becky's increasingly desperate attempts to control her. Most damning of all is the discovery that Becky had called child services 7 times seeking help, but her pleas went unanswered due to systemic failures. The truth about Janie is far more complex and disturbing than anyone realized. She wasn't just a victim, but also perpetrator of violence from an early age. Throughout the novel, Hannah and Christopher face an impossible choice: continue trying to help a deeply traumatized child who poses a danger to their family, or admit defeat and send her away. This dilemma tears at the foundation of their marriage and their identities as parents, forcing them to question everything they believed about unconditional love and their capabilities as caregivers. Christopher remains Janie's staunchest defender until the end. Despite witnessing her violent outbursts and manipulative behavior, including incidents where she hurt their pets and threatened other children, he continues to believe in her capacity for healing. His background as a child psychologist both helps and hinders him. While he understands the theoretical frameworks of childhood trauma, his professional investment makes it harder to maintain objectivity. When he visits her at New Horizons Residential Treatment Center, he's moved to tears by her artwork, especially a drawing of them holding hands under a rainbow. "Despite everything she's done, I love her in ways I can't describe," he reflects. His dedication to Janie stems partly from his own childhood experiences with an unstable home life, making him particularly sensitive to abandoned children. Hannah, however, reaches a different conclusion. After Allison's death, she makes a firm decision. "I've decided I'm never letting her back in our house. I don't care if there's no proof of what happened on the stairs. She killed my sister, and I'll never see her again." Her position is shaped by months of witnessing Janie's escalating behavior, including finding mutilated dolls hidden in walls and discovering detailed drawings of family members being hurt. The loss of her sister becomes the final breaking point, transforming her from a determined adoptive mother into someone who can no longer separate love from fear. The contrast between their positions highlights the impossible situation they face. There is no clear right answer, only painful choices with lasting consequences. Their marriage begins to crack under the strain, with Christopher sleeping in his office and Hannah seeking solace in anxiety medication. Even their extended family becomes divided, with Christopher's parents supporting continued efforts to help Janie, while Hannah's family demands they prioritize their own safety. The novel refuses to offer easy solutions or moral certainty. Instead, it forces readers to confront uncomfortable questions. What are the limits of parental love and responsibility? How do we balance the needs of a traumatized child against the safety of other family members? Can some children be beyond our capacity to help? Through careful exploration of both perspectives, the story illustrates how good people can reach vastly different conclusions when faced with impossible choices. The author particularly excels at showing how past experiences and personal histories influence these decisions, making both Hannah's and Christopher's positions understandable, if irreconcilable. One of the most damning aspects of The Perfect Child is its unflinching portrayal of systemic failures in child welfare. Piper Goldstein, the social worker assigned to Janie's case, becomes emotionally invested in the Bowers, viewing them as like family and considering them among the best foster homes she's seen in 20 years. Yet Piper misses crucial warning signs. She fails to recognize the severity of Janie's attachment issues, dismisses Hannah's concerns about Janie's behavior toward her, and doesn't adequately prepare the Bowers for the challenges they'll face. When Janie bites through her own lip, requiring 12 stitches, Piper defends the Bowers, but doesn't recognize this as evidence of how dangerous the situation has become. Most critically, investigators later discover that Becky Watson, Janie's biological mother, had called child services 7 times seeking help before her death. Piper was the social worker assigned to her case, but never followed up. "I'd never even heard of Becky until meeting Janie in the hospital," she admits, stunned by the revelation. The system failed them both. This institutional failure extends beyond Piper to the entire child welfare system. Despite Janie's obvious psychological issues, she isn't placed in a therapeutic foster home with trained professionals. When the Bowers struggle to manage her behavior, they receive inadequate support and guidance. Even after multiple concerning incidents, including killing a pet and physically harming other children, Janie remains in their care without sufficient intervention. The novel serves as a powerful indictment of a system that chronically underfunds child welfare services, overburdens social workers with impossible caseloads, and fails to provide adequate resources for children with severe trauma histories. Through Piper's belated realization of her own complicity, Barry highlights how even well-intentioned professionals can become part of the problem when working within a broken system. At its heart, The Perfect Child grapples with the age-old question of nature versus nurture. Was Janie born with something fundamentally wrong with her, or was she shaped by her traumatic experiences? The novel refuses to provide a simple answer, instead presenting compelling evidence for both possibilities through multiple perspectives and a series of increasingly disturbing revelations. Sue Watson, Janie's grandmother, describes her as an unsettling baby who never slept but never cried either, just stared at the ceiling, emotionless. This suggests something might have been different about Janie from birth. Later, Sue claims Janie's eyes would turn black as night during her violent episodes, implying an innate darkness within her. Other early caregivers reported similar observations. The hospital nurses noted her unusual stillness, and her first foster mother described her as unnaturally quiet and watching everything like a little adult. Yet the novel meticulously documents the severe abuse and neglect Janie suffered throughout her early years. She was abandoned by her mother as a newborn in a trash-filled apartment, physically abused by her grandmother, who would lock her in a dark basement for hours, and later tied up in a closet by her mother during drug-fueled binges. These traumatic experiences would profoundly impact any child's development and ability to form healthy attachments. The story reveals layers of generational trauma, with Janie's mother having endured similar abuse at Sue's hands, creating a cycle of violence and neglect. Dr. Chandler's diagnosis of reactive attachment disorder provides a clinical framework for understanding Janie's behavior. This condition develops when children cannot form healthy bonds with caregivers during critical developmental periods, typically due to neglect, abuse, or institutional care. Children with RAD often exhibit manipulative behavior, struggle with empathy, and have difficulty regulating their emotions, all characteristics Janie displays. Through detailed therapy sessions, we see how Janie's inability to trust adults manifests in increasingly dangerous ways, from calculated manipulation to sudden violent outbursts. The discovery of videos showing Janie attacking her mother complicates this picture further. The footage reveals a pattern of escalation, but also shows moments of genuine terror and defensive behavior from Janie. Was this the action of a child defending herself after prolonged abuse, or evidence of something more disturbing? The novel explores how trauma can create a feedback loop where victim becomes perpetrator, blurring the lines between cause and effect. The story delves deeper into this complexity through parallel narratives of other troubled children who experienced similar trauma but developed differently. Some recovered with proper care and therapy, while others, like Janie, seemed resistant to intervention despite identical circumstances. This nuanced approach suggests that perhaps the answer lies not in choosing between nature and nurture, but in understanding their intricate dance together in human development. The novel doesn't definitively answer this question, instead leaving readers to draw their own conclusions about the complex interplay between biology and environment in shaping human behavior. Through careful documentation of both Janie's inherited traits and her environmental influences, it demonstrates how nature and nurture are inextricably linked, each amplifying or diminishing the other's effects in ways that defy simple categorization. Perhaps the most haunting aspect of The Perfect Child is its portrayal of how quickly a seemingly stable family can unravel. The Bowers begin as a loving couple with a beautiful home and successful careers. They approach parenthood with the best intentions, believing their love will be enough to heal Janie's wounds. Yet within months, their marriage is in tatters, Hannah is in a psychiatric ward, Christopher faces criminal charges, and both children have been removed from their care. The novel challenges our cultural narrative that love conquers all, especially when it comes to parenting. Despite their genuine love for Janie, the Bowers cannot overcome the damage done by her early experiences. Their failure isn't due to lack of effort or commitment, but to the reality that some wounds run too deep for even the most devoted parents to heal. This theme extends to the fragility of mental health as well. Hannah's descent into postpartum psychosis happens gradually, then suddenly, her mind betraying her despite her best efforts to hold everything together. The novel portrays her illness with compassion, showing how a combination of sleep deprivation, hormonal changes, and extreme stress can trigger psychosis, even in someone with no previous psychiatric history. By the end of the novel, the Bowers' once perfect life lies in ruins. Their home, once a symbol of their success and stability, becomes a place of trauma and painful memories. Their marriage, though not completely destroyed, is fundamentally altered by what they've experienced together. Even their joy in Cole's recovery is tempered by grief over Allison's death and uncertainty about their future. The final scene, with Piper and the police arriving at their door with new revelations about Janie, suggests that closure remains elusive. Some wounds never fully heal. Some questions never receive satisfying answers. In this unflinching portrayal of a family in crisis, Barry reminds us of the precariousness of happiness and the limits of our ability to control our own lives. The Perfect Child concludes without neat resolutions or moral certainty. Instead, it leaves readers with the uncomfortable question at the center of the story. Was Janie a victim deserving of compassion and help, or a danger to others who couldn't be saved? The answer, the novel suggests, is both, and this contradiction makes her story all the more tragic. Janie was undeniably a victim of horrific abuse and neglect. She was failed by her biological family, by the child welfare system, and ultimately by the Bowers, who couldn't provide the specialized care she needed. Yet she also caused real harm, injuring other children, killing a pet, possibly contributing to Allison's death, and potentially killing her own mother. This complexity challenges our desire for clear heroes and villains. It forces us to confront the uncomfortable reality that human behavior exists on a spectrum shaped by countless factors beyond our control. Some children, despite our best efforts, may never be able to function in a family environment without specialized therapeutic intervention. The novel's power lies in its refusal to offer easy answers or comforting platitudes. Instead, it presents the messy, contradictory truth of human experience, that love can be both healing and insufficient, that good intentions don't guarantee good outcomes, and that sometimes there are no solutions that don't involve some measure of heartbreak. In the end, The Perfect Child is not just a psychological thriller, but a profound meditation on the limits of love, the lasting impact of trauma, and the difficult truth that some damage cannot be undone. It reminds us that in the face of such complexity, compassion for victims, for parents, for ourselves, may be the only truly adequate response.